Hi there, and welcome to Plant CEO. In this special episode, I'd like to welcome Ali Talbrizi, the director of Seaspiracy. Hey, Ali, how are you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Great to have you on the show.
Absolutely, it's a pleasure.
So first of all, congratulations on the huge success of the documentary. One of the major stats for me was that 2.7 trillion fish are being slaughtered each year, which means that there's no longer going to be fish in the oceans by 2048. So it really is the time to redefine our relationship with the blue planet.
Absolutely. People are not aware of the fact that the fishing industry is the leading threat. I mean, it kills more wildlife than anything else. Most people think that wildlife poaching is a guy in the woods, in the jungle with a shotgun. But really, this is wildlife poaching. That's what fishing really is. And, you know, the best estimates show somewhere in the region of 2.7 trillion fish are caught per year at its peak levels, but no one really knows the exact number. These are unimaginable numbers to try and, you know, fathom. And also, we don't have exact estimates for when the ocean will really run out of fish, or at least commercially viable to go out and fish. But in the region of the next 50, 30 years, we could see many areas of ocean already empty. And today, you can go to several regions of the world and it's just not commercially viable to fish because they've all just been plundered. So we absolutely do need to redefine our relationship with our oceans and realize that the leading threat to our seas is the fishing industry.
And I guess, you know, you highlighted very clearly in the documentary the parts where, you know, 1830s, where fishing was quite abundant in terms of the amounts, to where we are today with the trawling and the effect that also happens to the phytoplanktons as well, is causing immense damage.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, the number you referred to there in the 1830s was the halibut fishery, I believe it was, in the North Sea. In just a day, one of these boats could take, you know, was it 1 to 2 tons? Compared to today, you need the entire fleet an entire year to catch that amount. And so some fish species are just more than 1,000 times less abundant than they are today. But it's across the board. 90% of all the world's large fish have gone. That's not from plastic. That's not from water pollution. That's not even from climate change. It's from the fishing industry. It's absolutely shocking, the things that we were able to uncover in this film.
Can you highlight what sort of reactions you've had, both, I guess, on the positive side and on the negative side since its release?
Mm. It's been overwhelmingly positive, and we're getting thousands of messages from around the world talking about how the film has affected them and the conversations that have started as a result of it. And it's from all walks of life. We've had people who are already involved in the environmental scene, people who had no idea what was going on. This is their first dip into the world of our you know, their sort of eco-consciousness. And we've had even fishermen, spear fishermen, seafood chefs, we've had marine scientists, we've had people from all walks of life, A-list celebrities to your next door neighbor. It's truly gone viral, and we were not expecting that to happen.
What's the sort of reaction from the seafood chefs been, especially as they've been in it, you know, in the day-to-day offering fish in their restaurants?
Yeah, so there's a story from a restaurant in Hong Kong that I believe has now taken seafood off their shelves, off their menus, and have just stopped. They've kind of just stopped because of the result of the movie. We've had seafood chefs write to us saying that it seriously made them reconsider their menu and are changing their menu now and moving towards the more plant-based direction. These are all things that when people say that these kinds of documentaries only really preach to the choir and it's already people who are already interested. This film, for some reason, has been able to reach everyone in all demographics and all walks of life.
I've definitely seen that as well. You know, when I speak to friends who've seen the movie, who are consuming meat and fish, actually, that they would say different parts of the film highlights it for them, like, one was about the Faroe Islands. I know that kind of disturbed me quite a lot, especially when seeing the pregnant whale. But also the harpooning of that in those islands. But and then other people are talking about the finning of the sharks. So it's quite interesting to see that behavior, how each person has reacted to it differently.
Yeah, I agree. It's something that as a film editor, you know, you stare at this footage for years and you become desensitized to it. You don't really see what it is anymore. And there's some, we managed to really piece together a lot of the puzzle, which so far hasn't really been done in an ocean film before, because they've always been on just the plastic story, just the shark story. But we really wanted to get the big picture and connect as many of these dots as possible. And another thing that really surprised me was the sort of amount of people that were crying at certain points in the movie, where I would have thought, well, hold on, that's a really weird, that's like, for me, not what I would have expected to have a, you know, a tear jerking moment. So it's, yeah, it's been, that's something that I really enjoy, is just reliving the film through people's fresh eyes from hearing their feedback. Yeah.
Is there some sort of count that you think that, which moment made people quite emotional?
Yeah, I think the Faroe Islands towards the climax of the movie is where a lot of people get really emotional about. And also other parts, like when people have seen the West African canoe fishermen begging for food, and that shot out at sea, and people, that was a tear-jerking moment for some friends of ours as well. So yeah, it's been across the board. And even from the beginning of the movie, when we're just talking about plastics, and a lot of people that didn't know the plastics numbers, it just made them really, it was really an eye opener for a lot of people that didn't know that. So throughout the whole course of the movie, usually tearjerkers are right at the end, but somehow we've got a lot of people to cry throughout. Yeah.
And it's quite funny, like, you know, since they've watched the films, they've said, right, that's it, I'm giving up seafood now. But I'm going to finish the one that is left in the freezer. So as soon as that's done, that's it. There's no more after that.
Yeah, I even saw some, I mean, I don't support food waste, but there was a few videos people have sent us of going into their fridge and grabbing the seafood and putting it in the bin. I'm like, oh God, at least feed it to your cat or something. But yeah, it's truly had an impact on people, because it's been, so far, no one's really covered this story. I mean, who would have thought a film about fish and fishing was going to go viral? And it has. And I think people were ready for an authentic look into what was happening on our blue planet, and actually looking at the other side of the story, not just the pretty, you know, slow motion shots of dolphins and stuff that we've become a little bit more used to. But, you know, what's actually going on out there? What are the corporate interests? What are the financial ties, the corruption? What's actually going on there? And I think that's what's really, you know, struck people.
Yeah, I think it helps that, you know, you're very down to earth and very genuine in the way you've explained it as well, as well as your partner, actually. So I think that really comes across in the documentary as well. Makes it more relatable.
Yeah, Lucy, who's the assistant director and also now is my wife. We didn't start that way. We just started on this journey together as friends making this film. And, you know, now so we're married and everything. It's something that was really important to us. We wanted to make sure this was a relatable story that people could follow, that although we've got whole entire folders on our computer filled with facts, but we didn't want to just ram all those facts, because it's going to go past most people's ears. And so we wanted to make sure it was digestible, that we had the right animations and the right voiceover, and just to make sure that, you know, we're letting the audience know what we're learning, as we are, because we were learning all this stuff for ourselves, and we had to just sort of process it and then be able to retell it in the film.
Yeah, you must have had some like difficult days of filming and not feeling, I guess you felt in some situations that should you try and stop some of the things that you saw happening?
That's a great question. There's several moments in the film where you challenge yourself as a filmmaker, as opposed to someone who's interfering or some kind of activist or something. Several moments come to mind. I mean, the Faroe Islands, of course. You're on a beach and you just got all these people just ready to dive in and start killing these whales. And we just watched it. And before you know it, we're, you know, shin deep in this red blood water and just wanting to speak to people and go like, you know, stop, what are you doing, kind of thing. It was incredibly emotionally draining and traumatizing especially for Lucy as well. That was something that she was really affected by. And I think the interview with the whaler later on was actually a real revelation as well, because that's something in the film where most people are thinking, you know, look at these people, what they're doing is so evil. But the Faroese whaler was really able to turn it around and say, well, look, this is what we do. But guess what? when, you know, the rest of the world is slaughtering so many more animals in the fishing industry. So if you eat that cod or that salmon or that whatever it is, that tuna, chances are it's probably being caught alongside other dolphins, whales, and porpoises, you know, and really turning it around. That's one moment. But another moment was in Thailand, you know, when you're over there, and we're there to tell their story. We went voluntarily to try and, you know, hear their side of the story of what's happening with the human rights abuses. And you do want to do something. You want to be able to try and track down other slaves and help them try and escape. And there was even stories of NGOs that are doing that and just paying something like £100 or £300 to buy someone's life away from this cruel industry. That's how cheap it is to save someone from a lifetime of you know, forced labor. So we wanted to do that, but also we were just, it could be a little bit risky when you're in these situations, and we just had to get out of there. There's others that come to mind, but yeah, it was challenging.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be great if you can expand on that, the human rights issue that, mm-hmm. that you highlighted. And I think it was very clear from the fisherman in Thailand who, you know, was reenacting his experience of what happened with boiling water being thrown on him, the bodies in the freezer, small children being thrown overboard. But also, maybe not everyone picked up on it, but he also had a plea, didn't he? He actually said, I would like everyone to stop supporting them, as in the fishing industry. And, you know, that was quite a moment, I think.
Absolutely. That was something that struck me as well. And you know what? Those interviews, when we filmed them, this is a little behind the scenes for you, is we were doing the interview so quickly, and we just had these small little cameras, one tripod, we had to just go in and out, that we didn't have time for the translator to translate the answers. So we had no idea what they were saying until months later, when we came back, looked at the footage, sent it off to a translator, and then we're like, you know, we had no idea. So that was it was like seeing the interview for the first time. And so when we started getting the transcription through, we're like, you know, oh my God, it was really, really shocking. And one of the interviewees who I thought was going to be the worst interview, because he was slurring his words, you could smell alcohol in his breath because what he'd gone through was so traumatizing, ended up being one of the most powerful interviews. And it was shocking. You know, I'd heard about it before, what was kind of happening in the fishing industry, but I wasn't exactly sure what they were really going through. And so speaking to them was absolutely shocking to me. You know, like you said, these young boys being thrown overboard, their bodies floating on the sea surface later, days later, and this fisherman recounting how he felt so sad for their parents who'd never know about their son's death. And you're right, one of the things that one of the youngest Thai slaves said to me, and he was actually my age when we did this interview, we've lived completely different lives, was that he would love to see people stop supporting this forced labor seafood if possible. And that's something that people don't realize. If they watch the film again, they will realize is that throughout the movie, we never say, you know, I never say as a narrator or anything like, this is what you should do. Or, you know, it was coming from, again, like that whaler who made the point about the moral hypocrisy of killing some animals and not others. And also from that Thai slave who even said it from his own mouth. And again, that wasn't us forcing it from him, because we didn't know what he said until months later. So it was very much coming from the other end. And this isn't like a vegan film. It's just a real hard look at what's going on in our seas and letting people make up their own mind.
And the other parts that you highlighted was, you know, the potentially fraudulent practices of the certification labeling, you know, such as the blue tick and the dolphin safe. If you're eating tuna, you may well be funding the slaughter of also dolphins, whales, and sharks. What should the large FMCG brands be doing now that this has basically been exposed?
They need to take a long, hard look at what these sustainable labels actually mean, because for the most part, it's greenwashing, in my opinion, and it's got a lot of fluff. There's not a lot of meaningful definitions when it comes to this stuff. Sure, some fisheries are better than others, but when it comes down to something like the dolphin safe label, they can't guarantee that the tuna in that can is actually dolphin safe. It's like, we wouldn't stand for this when it came to GMO labels or organic labels. You can't say this is 50% organic or 50% non-GMO. It's fraud. What's the point of it? The whole point in these labels that in a world that is uncertain, that it's a bit of uncertainty. But like the guy said in our interview, says like, yeah, you can't guarantee that this is dolphin safe. The guys that are out there, they're meant to enforce this stuff, are rarely there. When they are there, they can get bribed by these fishing captains. And he just laid it all out in front of me. And what was I meant to do with that? And since they've tried to say that we took it out of context, but you can't take what, that's what they said. It was not out of context at all. And so, yeah, it goes for all these sustainable labels. So to your question, what should these, you know, fast moving consumer good companies like, you know, high street retailers of seafood do? In my opinion, it's we need to, and the whole world's doing this anyway, we need to move more into the direction of alternative plant-based proteins. It's the most efficient way to feed the planet. It's the most ethical way. It's the most environmentally sound way of doing it. So that should be the general move. And that's just the general trend we should be doing. And we should be really looking skeptically at anything that's claiming to be, you know, this is sort of sustainable label or dolphin safe, because I don't trust them.
Yeah. So, you know, people kind of vote with their money and, you know, in terms of what ends up on their plate. So, you know, consumers should be looking at this, at greater skepticism, because they need to know what harm is being caused, what impact it's having, what real impact it's having, right? And there are so many alternatives now. When you look at the plant-based field, you look at innovation that's happening with also cell-based food. But, you know, there's people that are using fish made out of jackfruit or banana blossom or tomatoes. You know, there's so much happening where there's now choices. So you really also see this as a key driver to reflect on those.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, and this is what we've heard as well a little bit in sort of reading some of the comments on social media, is like some people saying that it could be, you know, what do you say to people who can't afford those fish alternatives? And for that, I'd say, you know, plant-based foods can be some of the cheapest foods that you eat, and it can be nutritionally sound, and you can thrive on it at all stages of life. And so really these are luxuries, but you can make things out of like chickpeas and jackfruit, like you said, and banana blossom, that you can create the same mouthfeel experience of seafood. And the thing is, those synthetic versions, you know, the sort of plant-based fish fingers and cod and tuna and salmon, all those things that are becoming more and more available now are getting cheaper. As more of the world picks up on them. And don't forget, the fishing industry is incredibly subsidized. So what you think is, a 3 or 4 pound fillet of fish or something, the true cost of it is going to be many, many times higher than that, because guess what? You're paying for it twice. You pay when you pay your taxes, and that goes to the fisherman, and you pay when you go to the supermarket. And so, yeah, it's just keeping that in mind. But yeah, absolutely. Consumer demand, supply and demand is playing a huge role in this.
Yeah, and I'm not so happy that my taxes are being paid towards subsidies of the fishing industry, right?
Yeah, it's insane.
Especially when there was those stats to do with ending world hunger.
Yeah, so according to the United, so globally $35 billion, somewhere in the region of $35 billion goes towards the fishing industry. According to the United Nations, you need about $30 billion to solve world hunger. So you're going to have a nice $5 billion in spare change to go do some great work with. Maybe you can create some marine protected zones with that money. And in half in Europe, this is something that didn't make it into the film. So many countries in Europe, that the data is available for, the subsidies going out don't equal the value of fish coming back in. And sometimes they're not getting anything back in fish. So countries, especially landlocked countries, are paying millions to the fishing industry, and they're getting zero back in the form of seafood products. Oh, wow. So this is a huge drain on those countries' resources and money, when it could go back into so many other great things. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. And going back to the big FMCGs, some of these big firms do have now a plant-based line, right? Mm-hmm. But they're still pushing the other products because the consumers are still demanding it. And I think that's really what needs to change, because, I mean, the other thing is they could take a hard line. I don't think they will, but they could take a hard line and say, that's it. You know, we're killing this line of product, and we're just going to invest now on the plant-based market because we know that's the future.
Yeah, realistically, like you said, I don't think the world's the or places, maybe some places more than others, but I don't think the world's ready to do that just yet. And so this is why one of the most important things that we need to be doing and encouraging governments to do is incentivizing industry to move in that direction and create nutritionally equivalent, taste equivalent alternatives to those products. Because you know, some people like myself, like I don't know, even though I've grown up all my life eating fish and chips and cans of dolphin safe tuna and salmon, those things, you know, that someone who's on the southeast coast of England, like that's just part of what you eat. I've got no problem doing that because the ethics come in, the environment comes in, my love for the ocean far outweighs my convenience of, you know, moments pleasure on the tongue. So I don't mind if I don't eat any of those things ever, but for a lot of people, they need that transition. And I think that's why this film has landed so well now, is because there are those transitions now. And so, yeah, that's what we need to do. The government needs to incentivize these plant-based alternatives.
Yeah, for sure. And I think they just need more lobbying in order to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this film's helping to do that. The conversation started and we've got some upcoming campaigns that are going to be pushing for that.
Okay. That's awesome. So what do you say to the people who aren't ready to go 100% plant-based? You said a little bit about that, about the transition or vegan overnight after watching the film.
Yeah. Look, I mean, if people even choose one day to go plant-based, it's going to be an incredible, incredible thing for our oceans, and increasing that to 2 days, 3 days a week. And then before you know it, you're doing it for a whole week and then you carry on from there. I think that's how everyone really starts. Some people go overnight, but just encouraging more of that, that's the best thing we can do. So start small if you can't go overnight. If you do go over, you know, go plant-based overnight, that's fantastic. And I think that's the best thing. But if you're not quite ready that yet, even just some gradual steps, and you'll be surprised. Just a lot of the time, it's just knowing what to eat. It's as simple as that. And there's great resources online for that. And before you know it, it's not that big scary task that you think it is. And it's actually quite simple and you won't think about it. Like, I don't necessarily read labels anymore. It's just very intuitive. It's very easy for me. So yeah, just gradual steps can be good, but yeah, there's lots of resources online, including on our website, but there's loads out there.
Great. And when you know, saw the end result of the film, what would you say is your personal highlight from everything that you've put together?
In terms of
either the process or the end result, like you're making it, or the you know, the certain clip or something that you'd like to highlight?
So, well, that's a really good and difficult question. I think the delayed gratification on this for several years, I mean, it's like 4.5 years on this, and then seeing it suddenly get the great response has been incredibly gratifying. And it's great to see that the film has achieved far more than we ever hoped it would. But I've learned so much on this project. I never went to film school or university or studied filmmaking at all. And this is just a very, very independent passion project that I just needed to do. And so I just learned an incredible amount about filmmaking, documentary filmmaking. And, you know, I started this when I was like, you know, 22, 23 and 24, and I'm still making this film and just learning. And so I'm just really looking forward to putting what I've learned into the next film and then the next film. So just it's a hard question. I've learned a lot making the film, but it's been great to see the response. It's incredible.
So you mentioned that you didn't come from a filmmaking background. What was your background before you created
this? I mean, I just went to school like everyone else and college. And so, I mean, I studied like for 2 years art and design and art history. But, you know, after that, I traveled to India for like 6 months when I was 18, just on my own, flew over there and just traveled the country with my camera. I've always had a passion for photography, photojournalism. I was actually really interested in war photojournalism for years, like even when I was like 13 or 14. That's what I for some reason wanted to do. And so I always had this keen interest in visual storytelling. And so when I started to, and especially growing up as well, you watch these documentaries from David Attenborough and just this huge love for our natural world. And so combining those two, it just sort of, I couldn't really escape it. It was naturally leading me in the direction of just making films. So yeah, that's kind of my background. There isn't really a qualified background. It's just a lot of passion and hard work.
Yeah, that's what it takes for sure. And thinking about the military photography, I guess that's maybe how you got Paul De Gelder, right? He's an amazing character.
He's a beast. He's incredible. Yeah, and other people have pointed that out. There's like an element of that sort of investigative grittiness to this film that I think has kind of shone through a little bit.
Yeah, and I like what he said. You know, obviously he was. Well, I quite liked what you did there, where you had a close up of him. You didn't know where he was coming from, and then he was attacked from the shark, and now he does filming and he's pro sharks. And the bit that he said about knowledge dispels fear was awesome as well.
Yeah. Oh my God, he's incredible. He does a lot of great work for sharks, and he's a great role model for a lot of guys. So it was a pleasure to have him in the film.
Yeah. So in terms of what's next, or I guess, how are you thinking of carrying the Seaspiracy message forward to carry that interest for people who, spark the interest of other people who haven't seen it forward, but just to give it more life? What are you planning to do? I know you're doing a lot on the website at the moment. Mm.
Yeah, so, I mean, for me, I think Seaspiracy is going to be a project that continues for my whole life. I think what is happening in our oceans is such a huge story that, I mean, it's amazing what we were able to cram into this one film, but really there's so much that we left out. And so our social media, a lot of the stories that didn't make it in is going to find a home on our social media. So we're already creating lots of videos and carousels and infographics and campaigns, and we're just going to be continuing the mission and the movement of the film on social media with more content that didn't make it in. And that's something I'm going to be pursuing. And we've got loads of people worldwide reaching out about all these incredible stories and things that are happening where they are that no one knows about. And so it's sort of being channeled through the social media pages for Seaspiracy. As well as that, I'm launching Disrupt News, which is going to be highlighting even more environmental and social stories, which go beyond just the ocean. I was hoping to have that ready for, the week after the launch of the film, but the influx of the media for Seaspiracy has kind of meant that I'm going to have to launch that a little bit later this month.
And that, by the way, that will be a news channel, as in written
addresses
and video content on there.
Yeah, so there'll be video content, articles, podcast, and just a lot of media content that shares beyond just the scope of. I mean, really, my interest is those stories at the intersection of the environment and social issues. And there's, as the oceans are the thing I'm very, very much passionate about, but it goes beyond. There's so many stories happening on land that people have no idea about that's being forgotten. And so it's kind of continuing the sort of theme of how Seaspiracy was made, but tackling these other big issues that no one's really been looking into.
Yeah. I mean, what other big issues do you see making up that content? Do you think everything to do with animal agriculture, is it to do with climate change, sustainability in terms of energy, electric vehicles, fashion?
So many of the things you just mentioned, and with an emphasis on bringing that human element in as well. But for example, something that most people have no idea about is if you ask people what species are going extinct right now, they might mention, the cheetah or the lion. Lots of the megafauna that are on our planet. Most people have no idea the main reason why those animals are going extinct is because of animal agriculture on land and fishing in our oceans. And unfortunately, many times it's being misdiagnosed as, for example, plastics or climate or something else. And so really it's drawing attention to what is the leading threat to the natural world, to these species, and even to the people in these environments. Like in the Amazon rainforest, a lot of the indigenous groups there are losing their land, they're losing their rights, they're losing their home because of these huge animal agriculture industries that are coming in and wiping out everything. And so it's highlighting those stories and also many of these activists that are being killed just trying to protect their land. So it's really just, creating a space for those stories to live in so that it can get, as many people aware of what's going on as possible.
Yeah, the devastation that's happening to the Amazon rainforest is partly because they're growing feed to feed the animals with soya or corn or whatever. Mm. So yeah, it's directly related to what's happening there. And, obviously, there was the Inconvenient Truth, where they did highlight even animal agriculture being the main reason for climate change. But in a way that was, I think, subsequent interviews that I saw with Al Gore, is the reason that he didn't touch on it is because he thought it was too much of a sore point for the Americans to basically relate to that, because food is very cultural.
I also think there might have been some conflict of interest with that story as well, because I'm going to have to look into this more, but maybe you could as well. I believe at the time of making it, he was involved in cattle farming as well himself.
Ah, was he?
I wish I had the research ready to tell you this, because I don't want to say anything that's not true. But right. I read that, and it happens a lot where people don't want to talk about something that's a little bit too close to home. And so, yeah, it happens, but yeah, so there's so many huge stories that unfortunately are just, you know, people think what they know a little bit what's going on in our environment, but really there's so much that we've been finding out that there's going to be sort of breaking news when we release it. So,
yeah. And, how can people, help with your mission?
Well, they can watch the film and they can share the film with their friends and family and keep this conversation going. I mean, it's already in the top 10 globally on Netflix, and I think it's in the top 1 to 5 in many other countries.
Yeah.
But we need to keep this conversation going. We need to like share this with absolutely everyone. And that's what's been going on already. But really following us on social media, because as I said, there's so much that we didn't cover that we're going to be continuing to share on our social. It's going to be a great resource for everyone at Seaspiracy on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and those places. And visiting our website, that's where they can sign up to these email newsletters that are going to be coming out with petitions and events and fun things like that, and how people can get involved. And also later this month, we'll be launching DisruptNews.org. So at DisruptNews.org on Instagram and our website. But we'll be sharing that all over on Seaspiracy anyway. So that's really the main home that people can go and support and keep up to date.
Yeah. So will the news channel for Disrupt News just be on Instagram, or are you creating a separate domain?
Separate. So just think of them as like separate things. So they'll cross share things, but it's really... This Seaspiracy will continue with the ocean stories, while Disrupt can start covering other issues as well.
Yeah. And are you thinking of your next documentary? I know we've previously spoken about the part, especially with the human rights issues, that you really wanted to focus on that as well. Mm-hmm. Have you had more thoughts? I know it's quite fresh now already be thinking about the next one, but do you have any initial ideas?
Yeah, there's several stories that I've got in sort of pre-production right now. It's just deciding which one we want to go for. There's several stories. I don't want to spill the beans on them, but they would be following a similar subject matter as Seaspiracy. And as I said, my main interest is in the stories at the intersection of environmental and social issues. But yeah, so we've got some stuff in the pipeline.
That's great. I look forward to supporting you with that and seeing the new stuff that you bring out, especially also with Disrupt News and the carrying on the conversation, actually.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, so thank you again for coming on the show, and really great to talk to you.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. It's been fun, and I look forward to the future podcast from you as well.
Thanks. All right, bye for now.
See you later.
Yes, bye.